Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Michal Kisin about his new book, From Utterances to Speech Acts. The book sets out a new philosophically and empirically motivated approach to the study of speech acts, which aims to address some of the shortcomings of existing accounts and to accommodate the findings from experimental work on developmental pragmatics. In this interview, we discuss some of the central planks of this theory and situate it within the larger, although recently neglected, tradition of research in this area. Welcome to New Books in Language. Today I'm talking to Michal Kisin about his new book, From Utterances to Speech Acts, in which he sets out theoretical and empirical evidence in favor of a new analysis of locutionary force. Michal, how did you come to be working on speech acts?
Hi. When I started as a master's student in linguistics, I got very interested in pragmatics, and it was the beginnings of all new lines of research in pragmatics, which started to be much more cognitively oriented. However, what was surprising at that time is that everyone seemed to be interested with topics like implicature and presupposition. And one of the big, huge parts of pragmatics, of traditional pragmatics, speech acts, was relatively left aside. So I just started to think how this topic could be researched from this new cognitive perspective. And then after my master's thesis in Cambridge, I got back to the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Brussels, where I'm still now, and I decided just to take this as a topic for my PhD dissertation. And basically, this is how I started to think about this subject, about speech acts, and eventually, this is how I ended up writing a book about it. So this is a brief glimpse of how it happened.
Yeah. Did you come to any conclusions about why the field had been so neglected from a cognitive perspective?
I guess there are two reasons to it. One is has to do with the sociology of the field, and because one of the greatest name in the study of speech act is, of course, Searle. But from the linguist's point of view, Searle's theory was seen as a bit artificial and also quite disconnected from questions about processing and the cognitive underpinning of interpretation. And the second reason is that simply analyzing declarative sentences and assertions is complicated enough, and so people just, I guess, thought that they will leave other speech acts, such as directives, that is, commands and requests or questions or promises, just they would leave them aside for, for the future when things will get clearer with about the pragmatics of declarative sentences and utterances. So this is my guess about the reasons of this neglect. I should say, however, that in recent years, for 3 or 4 years in different fields of pragmatics and philosophy of language and semantics, there has been a renewed interest in various kinds of speech acts and non-declarative sentence types.
Yeah, indeed. In your book, you expand the coverage from just declaratives to some other types of speech act types. In fact, you discuss what you categorize as constatives, directives, and commissives. Your theory identifies these as corresponding to three fairly fundamental but distinct aspects of our general communicative competence. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. One of the issues about different theories of speech acts is that sometimes they tend to get lost within questions of how classify different types of speech acts and how distinguish between major and minor types of speech acts, and whether apologies should be, for instance, a distinct kind of speech acts or not. I didn't want to get involved in that question, and I just think that providing information and trying to provide other people with reasons to do other things are two really fundamental ways to use language. And in the beginning of the book, I assume that this is presupposed and mutually agreed on. But what I try to show during the book is that we really can assume that this is the case for deep cognitive and linguistic reasons. As for commissives, I included them. So commissives are speech acts we use to commit ourselves to do something, promises, but also threats, offers, things like that. So the reason why I included these is because there has been some dispute in pragmatics on whether these kind of speech acts are culture-specific. So whether promises should be accounted for by looking at specific cultural institutions, whereas speech acts like assertions or testimonies or requests and commands, these should be analyzed from a cognitive transcultural perspective. So this, so for instance, in their really, really well-known books, Berber and Wilson in Relevance, they say that promises are really a cultural type of speech act. And there are some reasons to think that, some a priori reasons to think that this is not right, because basically we find this kind of linguistic behavior to commit oneself to do something all around the world, across different cultures and different languages, and also because children tend to acquire and the mastery of these speech acts along really clear developmental steps, which do not seem to depend on their cultural environment. So what I wanted to show is that these kind of speech acts can be accounted within a cognitive and naturalistic perspective, as well as what I call constatives, that is, speech acts aimed at conveying information, or directives, that is, speech acts which are used to influence other behavior, to attempt to influence other's behavior.
As you mentioned there, and also indicated in your introduction, you're quite skeptical about the use of these finer-grained taxonomies of speech acts. And you talk there about these presupposing a lot of theoretical commitments. Do you feel that that's actually something that's actively unhelpful in terms of obfuscating the kinds of psychological generalizations that we can make? Or do you feel that that's just perhaps those taxonomies are too advanced for our current level of understanding, and that's something that we should postpone for future study?
I think that the problem with PCHAT classifications is that they really depend on the theoretical commitments people who establish these classifications have. I have a recent paper that just came out in a handbook of speech act where I really address that question. I'm not sure that it's useless to think about different fine-grained types of speech act. For instance, if you look at the world's languages, there are languages which have a really specific minor sentence types. For instance, you have languages which have what is called a preventive mood, which is specifically used for warnings. So it's not the imperative. The imperative is used for commands, but preventive is used for warnings. So it might be useful, to ask these questions: how warnings are different from commands, and what this entails. But I do think that from a purely cognitive perspective, what we should be looking at is the translinguistic and cross-cultural processes that shape our practice of handling speech acts. So the reasons why we have these four major ways to use languages. So I just think that we shouldn't get lost in this classification issue. Also, because sometimes it tends to become completely superficial. It was the case, especially in the 80s and late 70s, where people really started to argue which classification is the best. I don't think that there is a good classification of minor speech acts. That depends on what you want to do.
Sure. Turning then, if I may, to your own specific proposal. In the first chapter, you distinguish illocutionary acts from locutionary and perlocutionary acts. But then you depart from some of the traditional precedents by arguing that not all locutionary acts have a direct locutionary force at all, which you mention is crucial for your account. Could you tell us about that insight?
Yes. So one thing I did when I started to work on speech act was to get back to Austin, who was the father of speech act theory, although he didn't call it like this. And what I realized is that Austin's one of the major insights was that any utterance can be interpreted in different levels. And what I try to do in this first chapter is to take this proposal seriously. And in a bit kind of weird way from a chronological point of view, because I think that Austin's major problem was that he had a theory of action, because he had a theory of action, which was in fact incompatible with his theory of speech act, of how to do things with words. And so I used Davidson theory of action to get a better understanding of these different levels of meaning distinguished by Austin. And so, in a nutshell, Davidson theory of action, if you don't want to get really technical, is that what is there out in the world are just events. So when I raise my hand to vote, for instance, what is there, ontologically speaking, just a physical event. And then we can interpret it in different ways. In some context, it would be just I raise my hand, but in some other, I will vote for someone to be chair or something like that. And Austin's idea was that at the basic level, what an utterance is just a production of sounds. It just, you know, you produce sounds, and these sounds reach your hearer, but there is nothing more to it. And this is what Austin calls a phonetic act. And then sometimes these sounds will have a structure which fits some syntactic morphological setup of a language. So this will be a phatic act. But the fact that an utterance, a production of sounds, has this, some morphosyntactic specific structure doesn't mean that it has propositional content. It doesn't mean that it represents something. For instance, I could be practicing my French and I say something like il chante, which means he sings, or je chante, I sing, but it doesn't convey anything. But at this level, my utterance still already has some morphosyntactic structure. Now, it may happen that, and this is what usually happens, that we're in a context where you are, as a hearer, you're also able to interpret this syntactic structure as conveying, as having a certain meaning, as having a propositional content. And one of the major contributions of the last 20 years in pragmatic was to understand how context contributes to fleshing out this content from this syntactic skeleton, so to speak. And this is what I think is right to call the locutionary act. Now, at that point in contemporary philosophy of language and pragmatics, people to say, okay, once we've reached this level where a syntactic structure has been enriched as to get to some content, well, we just got from linguistic meaning or phatic act, as to speak in Austin terms, to the level of speech acts. Now we have an assertion or something like that. So, for instance, if I say I sing, but you understand that this is what I'm meaning is that I, Mikhail Kissin, I sing usually, or if I say I'm singing, that I'm singing now in Brussels today, the 9th of September, then I'm just performing a speech act. And so you're right about it. This is one of the major claims of the book, is that's not right. There are many instances where we perform utterances that have a propositional content, but they're not used to perform any literal, at least, elocutionary act. And of course, one of the most obvious points is irony. If I say ironically that something like, you know, we went to see a movie, and it's mutually obvious to both of us that you know, the movie wasn't good at all. And I say something, this is the best movie I've seen in the last 5 years. You really need context to understand the propositional content of my utterance. You need the content the context to understand that this movie is the movie we've just been watching, and that the last 5 years, it's the last 5 years relative to the time of utterance. But you certainly not interpret my utterance as being an assertion that this was the best movie I've seen the last 5 years. And the thing is that these cases are not limited to declarative sentences. We have also these with imperatives. The example I give in the book, it's an example borrowed from Wilson and Sperber. You just spilled some wine on my carpet, and you clumsily attempt to wipe it off, and you're just getting things worse, and I say, go ahead, ruin my carpet. Again, I'm using an imperative here, but I'm not giving you an order in any sense, but still you need the context to understand what my carpet refers to, etc. And thinking in this way actually clarifies a lot of things. For instance, it helps to think about what Jakobson called phatic communication, but we can call platitudes, you know, things we just say for saying something. If I, you know, we're just out there, it's raining, and I say, wow, it's pouring out now. Well, you know, both of us, we know what's going on, so there is no assertion made there. But clearly, there is something more than just sentence meaning. It's something more. We have propositional meaning, but no speech act involved or performed, not literally at least.
Can I clarify? So when you talk about literal speech acts in this sense, or direct elocution, you're referring to ones that use the declarative content of the sentence in some way, or am I misunderstanding?
What I mean by direct and literal is the speech acts whose content corresponds to the content of the corresponding locutionary act. That is, these are the speech acts which have as a propositional content the content which has been fleshed out from the sentence meaning. So, for instance, if both of us, we know that if Peter is invited at a party, then Mary will never attend that party. And, you know, you ask me, is Mary coming tomorrow at the party tomorrow? And I say, Peter is coming. Well, here I have performed two speech acts. I have performed one direct one. I asserted that Peter is coming, but also asserted indirectly that Mary won't be there, because every time you can infer that, because every time Peter is somewhere, Mary won't be there. So why calling this indirect? Because the content of the indirect speech act has not been fleshed out from the corresponding sentence meaning. What happens for irony is basically, it's more or less the same thing when I say, this is the best movie I've seen in the last 5 years. What I want to convey is that the movie was awful, and this is the indirectly performed speech act. The only difference here is that I do not perform any direct speech act. I do not assert anything directly. So I hope this distinction, it's a distinction that I think is really important, and so I hope it gets across in the book.
Yes, absolutely. What I wondered was how it related to sort of traditional approaches to certain kinds of speech act that you don't discuss, things like greetings, where the surface form arguably doesn't seem to have propositional content, for example. It seems like that those are also amenable to the kind of analysis where they have no direct elocution, although I don't know if that's what you'd prefer for those.
Actually, this is a hard question, and as I say in the introduction to the book, is I just leave those aside for the moment, because I'm not certain how to treat them. One of the reasons is that things like greetings might be thought to be conventional, culturally dependent. So it's I'm not entirely sure whether they require the same kind of account I try to put forward for directive constitutives and commissives, for assertion, orders and promises, or whether they should be analyzed at least partly invoking some cultural conventions. So the quick answer is that I don't know yet.
Fair enough. Returning to your own proposal, in Chapter 2 you discuss intentional states for the capital I, and you propose another distinction that's, I think, fundamental to your account, that between potential and non-potential content. This essentially places a boundary between information about the world and information about the speaker's beliefs. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. It's indeed a fundamental part of my account, because if we distinguish between, on the one hand, sentence types, so phatic acts, so it's, and on the other hand, elocutionary acts, so speech acts, and in between we have something else, which is locutionary act, which I claim that we have something in between just bare sentence meaning and the speech act that has been performed, then we need to characterize somehow this intermediate locutionary level. And clearly, there is something different between an imperative and a declarative. And it's not only different at the level of the sentence type, and it's not only different at the level of the speech act performed. There is something different at the level, at this intermediate level, if I'm right. So my idea was that what's different for between a declarative sentence used to perform the locutionary, a certain locutionary act, and an imperative sentence used to perform a locutionary act, is that they have different modes of presentation. So for instance, if I say, Chris, call me, and I, Chris, you are calling me, or if I say, call me, the proposition expressed should be more or less, should be something similar. It's something like, Chris is calling me, at that time. But what's different is that this proposition is presented under a different mode. And my idea was that what happens is really the same thing as between wanting something, desiring something, like wanting you to call me at 1 p.m. and believing that you are calling me at 1 p.m. or that you will call me at 1 p.m. And the distinction here is between mental states or intentional states, that is, intentional state with an uppercase, is mental states that are about something, that they are about content out there in the world. So the distinction between potential and non-potential one is basically the distinction between mental states that have a content that is neither true nor false as far as the current state of information goes, and between mental states whose content is true or false according to what is your information state. So, for instance, if I believe that you are located in Los Angeles now, well, this is something that for me is true or is it might turn out to be wrong, and I think actually it's wrong. But crucially, it's something, the function of these mental states to provide me with information about the world that has better to be true. But then imagine that I want to, I have the desire to go to LA this summer. Well, as far as my information state goes right now, it's neither true nor false. And for this reason, I can have incompatible desires. I can want to have the desire to go to LA this summer, but I can also have the desire to stay in Brussels this summer. And at some point, I will have to decide between these two conflicting desires. But as far as I, as my current information state goes, these are neither true nor false. So these are what I call potential mental states. Now, it's exactly the opposite with beliefs. If I believe that you're in LA right now, I cannot believe at the same time that you are not in LA at right now. This is because these mental states are not potential. They are either true or they are false. If I realize that they are false, then I will exclude them from my beliefs. And actually, this distinction is really, really important if you think of how organisms function. If you have an organism that is capable of planning some action, of general planning, then this organism needs to have these potential mental states. Because if you want to plan things, what you need to have is some representations of alternatives. You need to be capable of deciding between different scenarios, and some scenarios that you prefer to others, but it's really crucial that before taking the decision, before you take that decision, these scenarios are neither true nor false. You don't know. And so this is basically the idea of this distinction, and I try to show that it's really plausible also from a philosophical point of view. And then my argument next is to say that basically we have exactly the same thing between different kinds of locutionary acts, between different kind of utterances. One crucial property of the imperative mood of utterances that are in imperative is that they cannot be judged as true or as false. If I tell you, sit down, you cannot answer that's not true, or that's not, or that's true, or that I believe it's true. But it's not only for orders. If I say something like, sleep well, or be careful. I'm using its imperative sentence type in languages other than English. It's like in French, it would be clear in imperative. And again, you cannot say that's true or that's false. It's just a good wish. It's not. It has nothing to do with the condition of performing commands or request. But still, you cannot answer it's true or false. And so the idea is that what we have is different functions. On the one hand, you have non-potential mental states, and their function is to provide the mind with propositional content which is either true or false. And we have, on the same side of the distinction, locutionary acts, utterances, like those cast in declarative mood, which have as a function to provide you with information that can be assessed as true or as false. On the other side of the divide, we have mental states, such as desires, and the function of these mental states is just to provide you with a state of affairs which is neither true nor false. And on the same side of the divide, we have utterances like imperatives, which have as a function to express a propositional content which is neither true nor false relative to what we currently know. And so basically, this is how we can define this mode of presentation on locutionary acts. So we have the same kind of mode of presentation on beliefs and on utterances cast in declarative mood, and the same kind of potential mode of presentation on desires and utterances cast in imperative.
Is it generally the case then that a particular sentence type, like the imperative form, is internally consistent in expressing, in this case, potential content?
So the idea is that different sentence type, different morphosyntactic structures have a function, and the function here is taken in an evolutionary sense. So there is a reason why they evolved in our practice, why we keep using them. And so my idea is that one of the reasons why we keep using imperatives is because their function is to express these kind of potential contents. As I say in the book, it's not the only kind of morphosyntactic structure that expresses potential contents. Subjunctives and what's called the realist moods in different kind of types of descriptions usually or very often express these kind of potential contents, contents that cannot be true or false as far as the current state of information goes. So what's really consistent about imperatives across languages is that they never ever can be used to express something that it's either true or known to be false. This doesn't mean that all languages have imperatives. Actually, there are languages with no imperative mood. But in languages which have an imperative mood, they would have this mood which is specified to express potential contents. And now there is a good reason why, when you have this kind of morphosyntactic structure, which can express only things that are neither true nor false, that you'd use this to perform directive speech acts, why you would use it to perform orders or requests. Because you can order or request something, only something that's not certain, which has not been true or known to be true or known to be impossible to do. So if you want to provide your addressee with a reason to do something, well, providing the addressee with a representation of a state of affairs where he's or she's doing something, but this state of affairs is this representation, the represented state is neither true nor false, then this is a really good way to perform directive speech acts. It's not the only one, but it's a really, really good way.
Presumably there's more to being an imperative than just expressing potential content, but presumably the fact that requests can be expressed using any of these various different means for expressing potential content doesn't mean that these means don't have other differences.
Yes, the issue of the structure and the semantics of the imperative mood is a really complicated one. And as I say in the book, this is not something I really wanted to solve. And we just have a book coming out from Cambridge University Press with Mark Jerry, and it's called Imperatives, where we really specifically look at the structure in the theories of the semantics of imperatives. What I just wanted to do in the book is to emphasize that on the one hand, there is something specific to imperatives, and this is the fact that they present the content as potential, but that the elocutionary force, the fact that they are not, that they're sometimes very often used as directives, this is not something built within their meaning. This is something that comes from the way they're used. There are many instances where imperatives are used with no directive force. So the clearest examples are good wishes. And on the other hand, we have a lot of cases where you have a request or a directive speech act, which is performed using a non-imperative sentence. So clearest examples are things like, could you open the door? Or, you know, if I'm your boss and I say something like, you're leaving tomorrow, or things even such as feet off the table, or something like that, substantials. And the other idea of the book is then that what makes you interpret an utterance as a certain kind of speech act, let's take the example of directive speech act, is not decoding something within this sentence, meaning it's not something that's conventionally encoded within the morphosyntactic structure. It is the role that these utterances can play relative to what is mutually known or accepted as true. And with the case of for directive speech acts, what I say is that if relative to what is mutually accepted as true, relative to our conversational background, an utterance is a reason to act for the addressee, a reason for the addressee to bring about the truth of a certain propositional content, then this utterance is a directive speech act. Now, being a reason to do something doesn't mean that it's an effective reason. It has just to be a sufficient reason. So, for instance, if you tell me, if you say, close the door, it doesn't mean that I will necessarily close it. But if our common knowledge is such that I know that it's possible that it could be a reason for me, good reason, an efficient reason, to close the door, then I will interpret your utterance as a reason to close the door, that is, as a directive speech act whose content is to close the door. Now, in this case, in the example I just gave, the content of the directive speech act is exactly the same as the content of the locutionary act. It is, Michal closes the door at some point. But if you say, if you have things like, could you close the door? I could interpret this utterance, again, relative to what's stated, what's mutually accepted, as a reason to close the door. But this time, we will say that the speech act is indirect because its content is different from the locutionary content, from what has been can be fleshed out directly from the sentence meaning.
Indeed, yeah. In parallel to the analysis of directive speech acts as reason to act, you discuss in Chapter 3 constative speech acts analyzed as reasons to believe. What are the kind of consequences of this versus traditional accounts?
So the problem is that we are kind of struck between two extremes. On the one hand, you have people who would say that the only thing that assertions or constitutive speech acts in general do is to represent the world as it is. This is too weak. Clearly, there is more to assertion than just representing the world as it is. And for these people, for instance, it's really hard to make sense of self-addressed utterances. You know, if I say, "Oh God, it's raining again," or "I'm running late," and I say it to myself, I clearly represent, you know, something. The world has been in certain ways, but it seems quite artificial to say that it would be an assertion. On the other hand, there is the most standard and classic Stalnaker's theory, and there a successful assertion is the addition of a content to a common ground. So if I say it's raining, if I assert it successfully, then now it's mutually accepted by both of us that it's raining. Now, this is too strong. This is confusing, as I argue, elocutionary and prelocutionary levels. So the prelocutionary level is a level of, in a nutshell, of causal consequences of an utterance on the addressee.
There are a lot of cases where we intend to perform a successful assertion, but we don't necessarily intend to make the hearer believe the content of that assertion. For instance, perhaps I want to make you some proposal, but what I really hope is that you will turn that proposal down, and because this is useful for me, I don't know, for some other reason. And yet I still intend to make this proposal. So the idea here is that if you define assertion and constitutive speech acts as reasons to believe, then you are just in between these two extreme positions. So my idea is basically that if an utterance relative to the common ground provides the addressee with a reason to believe something, that means that this is an assertion. It doesn't mean, however, that a hearer will necessarily end up believing that. So, for instance, take an example of what is not an assertion. We are in this. We just watched that movie, and you know, and I that I really hate that movie, and I know that you know, etc. And I say this is the best movie I've seen in the last 5 years. Here, the common ground is such that clearly my utterance cannot be a reason for you to believe that this is the best movie I've seen in the last 5 years. For that reason, this utterance will not be interpreted as an assertion. Now, imagine by contrast that you will never believe that, I don't know, Austin was right about speech acts. But I believe that he's right. And I can say, tell you, you know, Austin was right about speech acts. Now, there is nothing in common we believe, there is nothing mutually accepted about Austin. So my utterance is still an assertion because it relates to what is mutually accepted as true. It is a reason to believe that Austin was right. It will certainly not be an effective reason for you to believe that, but it's a reason to believe related to the common ground nevertheless. And so it is still an assertion. So this is basically where I think that my definition of constitutive speech acts as reasons to believe helps to solve some traditional problems.
Indeed, yes. And one other problem you discuss is the idea that complex, multi-layered intentions are always present in the understanding of speech acts. You devote a chapter to the developmental and pathological evidence that bears upon the treatment of speech acts. Would it be fair, in your view, to say that the data from populations with autism spectrum disorders falsifies this claim of complex, multi-level intention representation?
Yeah, so that's right. Because of what we mentioned just at the beginning of the interview, because speech acts have been quite neglected in cognitive pragmatics, people just tend to think that any account of speech acts should run along Gricean lines. So basically, any interpretive route of an utterance that ends up with interpreting this utterance as a speech act has to involve the attribution to the addressee of the intention to make some communicative, some informative intention manifest, etc., etc. So at least a four-layered communicative intention. Now, what I believe is that the way I define speech acts from a really theoretical point of view basically requires much less, at least in that proportion or in a great proportion of cases, to understand that an utterance is a constitutive or a directive speech act. All you have to do is to see whether it could be reason to act or to believe to some information state. Now, in really kind of adult, at the adult level, you will assess that relative to what is commonly accepted as true, but it's also possible to have a less sophisticated interpretation. You just take what you believe to be true, to be false, and if it's a reason to act, then it's a directive speech act. If it's a reason to believe, then it's a constitutive speech act. So the prediction here is that you could have some quite sophisticated pragmatics without necessarily having the cognitive equipment to attribute complex communicative intention and simply complex mental states. And what I do in this chapter is to review literature on neurotypical linguistic and pragmatic development and on autism. And basically, the line of the argument is that in autism and in very young children, there is no sophisticated mental state attribution. And if I'm right, what it should be the case is that some pragmatics should still be present. And in particular, if I'm right, what should be there is if you can conceive of different possible worlds, if you can conceive of what can be possibly a reason to believe or what can be possibly a reason to act, then you can interpret utterances as directive and constitutive speech acts. And indeed, there is a lot of evidence that young kids can do that, neurotypical kids. Now, with autism, what happens is that in autism, one of the cognitive characteristics of autism is some lack of cognitive flexibility, some problems with conceiving of different alternatives of the world. And this makes it difficult for the prediction. My prediction would be then that it makes difficult for these people, well, for people suffering from autism, to interpret utterances as constitutive or directive speech acts. And I review quite a lot of literature, and it tends to be the case. However, this doesn't mean that in autism there is no pragmatics at all. If you have pragmatic processes that do not require complex mind reading and that do not require cognitive flexibility, then they could be preserved. And I try to argue that this is the case, actually. And in fact, it's a line of research I'm currently pursuing from a more experimental side.
I was going to ask, because our time is nearly up, and that the whole book brings together so many interesting strands of research in many areas for possible expression. I mean, you also mentioned questions that you're working on another domain of speech acts. What are your own research plans going forward?
As I already mentioned, there are really two big open questions in the book. The first is how we should conceive of different sentence type, and the second is all the research and all the questions about mind reading and pragmatics. And so since I finished the book, I've been working on imperatives with Mark Jerry, and we have a book coming out, and we're trying to develop our own semantic model now. And I have projects on autism, trying to see to which extent this cognitive flexibility theory explains things, how the prediction I make in the book on the basis of the literature can be confirmed experimentally. So this is something I do now. I also work, this is another trend in the book, on the question of belief acquisition from utterances. So basically, in a nutshell, the idea is that if you don't have necessarily a lot of mind reading involved and utterance interpretation, then it's really likely that belief acquisition from speech is more or less automatic. And so this is something we do with a colleague of mine here who is a social psychologist, Olivier Klein, and we are running also an experimental project on that.
Well, it sounds like very many strands of fascinating work, and I look forward to reading more about it in the near future. For now, I'd better say, Mikhail Kassin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for interviewing me. It has been a pleasure.
I've been talking to Mikhail Kassin about his book, From Utterances to Speech Acts. This is Chris Cummins from New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.